Welcome to Crosstalk Podcast, where we inspire recovery from addiction and try to discover a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substances or are you already on that path, well, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories of your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up and let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts. And today we have a terrific episode. Not only do we have somebody who's walked the walk of recovery, we have somebody who's also an expert in addiction recovery in his own personal experiences. And I have somebody, you know, we're trying to get just regular guys, but there's nothing regular about this guy. I want to welcome Zach Clark to our podcast.
What's up, Corey? Thanks for having me, man.
So, Zach, you started your journey in recovery started maybe a little bit more than 12, 13 years ago?
13 years, yeah. August was 13, so on our way to 14.
So before you got there, talk a little bit about, you know, growing up years, you know, how things started. You can talk as much or as little as you want about it, but, you know, I'd love to know a little bit more about how you grew up and what went on.
Yeah, dude. I mean, look, it's funny. The longer you stick around, for me, the longer I stay sober. And, you know, recently I'm interested, obviously, in sobriety. And I love that. And my recovery is very sacred to me. But human change and understanding human, like why we are the way we are, I think I'm realizing more and more that so much of what happened in my childhood, good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't fucking matter, you know, kind of shapes who I am even today at 40 years old. And so, you know, I always tell people, like, I wanted for nothing. My parents are the best. They've been together. They just celebrated 49 years married. So, like, man, like, that alone is super inspiring. And, you know, I grew up in a home where there was a lot of love, you know, there was a lot of love. And my dad was just a hardworking guy that was trying to make ends meet for the family. Like, we always did. I didn't always have the nicest baseball bat. I didn't, you know, but, like, I had it. I had enough. Like, we had the nice house. We lived in a nice town.
Siblings?
Yeah, I'm one of five. I'm one of five. And so I'm the fourth out of five. I have a younger sister and then two older brothers and an older sister. And so by the time, like, you know, it got to me in high school, going out and drinking on a Friday or Saturday night was normal. My brother kind of paved the way for me to do whatever the hell I wanted to do. And, you know, this town I grew up in, I laugh because it's Haddonfield, New Jersey. And if you're from Haddonfield or from the area, you know, it's known as a pretty good school system. It's known as a pretty, you know, middle upper class place. But it's funny because it's this 1 square mile town. And so what happens is kind of like the parents go to the golf course or the golf club to drink, and the kids go to the 16th hole of the golf course to drink. You know, it's like, and that's how I grew up. And that's how, you know, I lived in high school and middle school.
So great family life, supportive siblings, nice school system, good education. So when you went to college or in high school, did things get off the rails a little bit, or you were able to control it?
I mean, I've told my story a lot, you know, and I it's very clear to me, and in the year 2024, right, we are seeing, I work in behavioral health care. I see the cases that are coming across my desk. You obviously work with a lot of people. We were just talking about a case where, you know, you do a lot of service, you work a lot of people into treatment, you've done some interventions. Like, I was just a guy that liked to party. I just loved partying. And the second I found that, you know, like, I chased that feeling for the next 10 years. So in high school, I played sports, I played basketball, I played football, I played baseball, I did the thing. I got the, you know, the B's on the report card, but my time to shine was Saturday night. You know, that was when I really, that's the feeling I chased. And then when I got to college, I feel like I had this drinking kind of like degree that I was going to share with all the new freshmen in my dorm and around that I'll never forget. Like the second night at college, I went to a small school in Pennsylvania, York College. I got busted for drinking and I was on the baseball team. And I remember the coach kind of kicked a couple of us, like kicked, you know, the consequence, kicked a couple of us off the team for like a week or so. And I had to tell my parents. And that was really like my first consequence. But then we got back on the team and everything. And for 4 years in college, I mean, like it was the same drinking. And
so I want to ask you a little bit more about that. You said when you were drinking, I guess it was all alcohol primarily. It might have been other things. But why did you feel like you were shining? It's kind of a predictable question. What did it do for you that made it so much better? Did you feel like, you know, you were the life of the party when you did that? Or did you feel more comfortable with people? Or it was just something you liked? Why'd you like it?
I mean, look, I think I try not to overcomplicate that answer. Like, it was a lot of fun until it wasn't. You know, it just was a lot of fun until it wasn't. And my group of friends, you know, we took great, like I had a very strong group of friends. And I think if you looked at us in college or in high school, you probably, based on today's standards, could have sent any of us away to rehab. Now, you know, at 40 years old, a lot of those guys are married with kids and very successful and doing their thing. And I was the one that kind of kept the train moving. And then, in college, the cocaine comes in, the Adderall comes in, and it starts to be this kind of science project of, you know, what's going to allow me to drink the way I want to drink, but continue to show up, you know, to the responsibilities I have in my life. And then that became the game, as you know, for years. And we're really good at that too. Like I can keep it together.
Did there come a time where you couldn't keep it together anymore?
Yeah, down the road, but like college, you know, I mean, it depends what you call keeping it together. Like one of my regrets in life is looking back in college and saying, man, if I was sober during that time, I probably would have been a better athlete. I probably would have been a better person. Like I probably would have studied harder. I probably wouldn't have, nothing against a sport management degree, but I studied sport management because I just felt like that was going to be the easiest path towards a 4-year, like maybe I would have actually taken an interest in something else. I am actually convinced, being around this thing long enough, that every case is different. I don't know why. Is it hereditary? Is it genetic? Did I manufacture my idea? I don't know. Like at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I have to be convinced that I have this issue so that I can actually do the work. This idea that I'm going to be able to like drink like a civilized person or do heroin once a week.
You're going to go to rehab and get taught how you can do it like a normal person.
But I never had that. I never had that. It was 0 to 100 no matter what. Like if I put one in me, there is no telling where I'm ending up. And that's how I know today, 13, 14 years later, that I can't, I mean, I still do that, you know, with food or whatever else it is. Like I never really had the sex thing, but it's like, for me, it's anything that's going to make me feel good. I'm going to chase that feeling until.
So the cautionary tale from somebody who's got a couple of decades older is that 20 something, maybe 30 years after I first got sober, I figured because I had all these great things going for me that things changed and I was a different person. And I found out when I started doing Oxy for back pain, shoulder surgeries, whatever, that the exact same person did the exact same thing. And I don't need to do it again. I'm where you are, but I had to relapse in order to find that out again. Now I know how the movie ends. I don't want to watch it again.
Yeah, I don't want to be right. I don't want to be right. I think that's the confusing thing for me, man. Like, as human beings, we put so much pressure on what other people think. And so to work in behavioral healthcare and to have people come to me on a daily basis and ask for advice around a surgery, around if I think they can drink again, I can make my suggestion, but then I have to detach from the results because I have too many stories of that where I say, hey man, like you know, I know some people that are in recovery that have gotten through some pretty extreme surgeries without having to take painkillers. If you really don't want to test this, I would do the best you can on Advil, on Tylenol, with resting. And it's going to be painful, but not as painful as, you know, another 5-10 years of being out there doing drugs. And I just have too many stories of people that aren't with us anymore that have the surgery and get on the pain and they never make it back. They never make it back, man. And that's why, like, and then I also have the story of the person that gets the surgery and they stay close to, you know, their fellowship and their community and they get through it and they stay sober. So, like, I'm not God in all this.
Yeah, we have the answers, but we can't answer the questions for the people. I had ankle surgery and Karen's head down in Florida said you do Toradol and Norflex works great. Only do it for 3-4 days. Post ankle surgery, I had no pain. But all you got to do is ask and inquire and not just keep it a secret and just do it. That's what the difference is. If you talk about it and you're connected, it's very hard to go down the wrong path if you stay connected with each other.
Well, I mean, and that's, I think historically, right? Like, have we lost ourselves a little bit as a society, right? Like, Advil and Tylenol actually works. There's actually data that suggests when you combine Advil and Tylenol, it can be just as strong as taking an opioid.
For pain relief.
Because we are in a society that thrives on bigger and better and faster and stronger and the feeling, we want the opioids because that's going to be the thing.
It translates into a lot of the same kind of principle applies towards what we're going to do to make our lives better. If you have that car, if you get that job, if you do this, then your life will be great. No. That's not the way it works. Right now, with you in this moment, I'm happy. I'm happy in this moment.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. That's where joy, that's where our lives are right here because I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like. But, you know, going back a little bit to your journey, I know I get the sense that you'd like to focus more on the second half, not the first half.
Oh, I'll tell you all the stories. I mean, I got great stories. I don't mind talking about that. Like, and I think to a certain degree, it's helpful for people to hear, like, you know, sitting in my car after my first rehab in my parents' driveway, smoking crack, dropping a crack rock into, you know, the seat, taking every seat out of that, literally out of the car in my driveway, there's like this, and looking for this one, you know, hit of crack. And my neighbor comes out at 7 o'clock in the morning. He's like, what's going on? And I think it's like the most normal thing ever. I mean, that's where it goes. You know, like we have no awareness. We're not awake. We're dead. We're the walking dead. And like, I have those stories for days. And how it got there for me was, I was a pedal to the metal kind of guy. And like, I could blame it on the brain surgery that I had and the opioids that were prescribed with that. I could blame it on, you know, growing up in a home where we would go to Eagles games and Phillies games and tailgate all the time. Like, but like at the end of the day, man, like this whole process for me is about like turning the finger back to me and owning my part of what has happened in my life. I always get nervous when someone in recovery or trying to get sober is just blaming everyone because what do we really need to do? Like look in the mirror and say like, I need to look at my part.
So you have a great story about how you turn things in a different direction.
Yeah.
I think I'd love to hear a little bit about that because people who listen to Crosstalk often are people who are looking for an answer, how they change, how they can possibly go from where you just described, where we both were at one point. How do you begin that process? What did you do?
So what happened for me, Corey, was I'll tell the abbreviated version. So at 25, so in 2009, I get married. And at that point, I am already well on my way to a pretty destructive life. And the only, you know, confrontation I have in that relationship is around my drinking. Everything else is secondary. So that's June of 2009. By October of 2010, I'm in rehab for the first time. And I have your classic Sandra Bullock 28 days rehab experience that our country knows about. And I could go down the whole soapbox of why the 28-day thing is, you know, a joke and just a made-up thing by insurance companies and payers and all that shit. But maybe that's on a on another episode. But so I do the 28-day thing, and they hand me a piece of paper, and they say go to an outpatient program. And like I am in the rehab. You know this story. I am the president of the rehab, and I'm telling everyone that I'm gonna, you know, like I know what to, you know what to do when you get out of here. You know all the rehab talk, and I'm drunk within, you know, 2 weeks of leaving that place. And the only thing good that came of that was my wife at the time, Jen. We signed a contract during the family program at this treatment center, Seabrook House, who's still around. They're still getting people well. That basically said if I drink again, she was going to leave me. And I did, and she left. And she saved my life. Because she was the first person in my life to say, I love you. Like, I really love you. I did not want this to happen. I want you to be okay. I want you to be well. And she did it with such a full heart. But I'm out. I love myself more. And it was so powerful, man, because like I didn't realize it at the time, but everyone else in my life was just co-signing my everyone. And I don't prescribe to, just to be really clear, like the hard boundaries. Like I don't believe parents should put their kids on the street. I don't believe like, you know, like how do you tell a mother to say, hey, make your 20-year-old sleep on the street because he's not stopping doing drugs? Like I'm not that guy.
But boundaries are important.
With love.
Right.
Because as an addict and an alcoholic, it's not about what you're saying. It's about how you're saying it for me. If you're saying it like this and I feel like you're coming at me, well, if you're saying it like this and I feel the love, no matter what you're saying, like I'm more open to, and I didn't get well in that moment. I went on a run for 8 months there that got pretty gnarly. And that's where the street drugs came in and the, you know, the smoking of the crack and the IV heroin use. And it just, it like the progression was real for me, you know, and what happened to your point was it, and this is the thing that I think is so fascinating about the work that we do. There's a lot of smart people in this country. There's a lot of smart people at care and treatment centers and the programs that we work with and interventionists and case managers and psychiatrists and psychologists. And a bank teller saved my life. A f-ing bank teller. And that tells me that we are all uniquely qualified to help people recover. Because I walked into a bank trying to cash one of my dad's checks. And this woman, Rhonda Jackson, saw me and knew something was up. And instead of calling the cops, she called my dad. And my dad was there within, you know, 30 minutes. There had been missing persons reports filed on me and my family was convinced that the next call they were going to get is that I was dead. And my dad walked into that bank, you know, through those doors and put his arm on my arm and he said, son, we're going home. And I say that story and I have the goosebumps and he was right. And the next day or two is kind of a blur, but I end up at Karen Treatment Centers and I stay there for 4.5 months. And that was that was August of 2011. And I think the important thing to acknowledge in that moment at 27 years old is before we were on air today, you said some nice things about me that I'm a pretty intelligent guy, that I'm pretty well-spoken, et cetera, et cetera.
I also said you're good looking.
Yeah. You said I'm good looking. I was going to leave that one out, but I, in that moment knew, and it's the hardest thing for anyone to do on this journey. For the first time in my life, I didn't have the answers. I had to surrender. And I've been surrendering every day since. Because the second I think I know better than my therapist, my sponsor, my support group, my doc, whoever it is, that's when I get myself in trouble. And it's still true today. I'm not, trouble is not drinking and drugging, but it's resentment, it's anger, it's fear. It's all the shit that I don't want to be today. And I moved to New York City in January of 2012 and I haven't left. It's crazy.
And you're still an Eagle fan.
Diehard Eagles fans. I mean, and that's I mean, you asked that question in jest, but like, dude, I went to the Eagles Super Bowl in 2018. My father's been a season ticket holder since 1966. I mean, we've been to hundreds of games together, and we cried together, dead ass sober, when the Eagles won the Super Bowl. And those are the moments that I think I'm going to lose when I get sober, because I tell myself I can't go to games, I can't go to concerts, I can't. I get to do that stuff more and actually be alive and awake to the feeling.
So you the 0 to 100 guy you described,
yeah,
is still right here today on our podcast. Yes. And I identify, I'm actually kind of a 0 to 90 guy. You're a 0 to 100.
You know how to stop for it.
Well, no, what I'm telling you is that I'm in awe of all the things you're able to do, and you're able to do everything you do well. I want you to talk a little bit. By the way, I know, because I've seen you on social media, you ended up on the field in a Phillies game, right?
I've had some crazy experience. Yeah, I mean, look, my life is fast. Again, believe that this world tells you to live a certain way. And I was well on my way to living the existence of married, 4 kids, living in my hometown, exit, you know, the whole thing. And I'm not shaming that life. I have friends that have that life, and they absolutely love it. I'm now 40, living in New York City, and I'm no closer today to marriage, any of that stuff. And I'm okay. You know, like, I'm okay. I actually love my life, and there is still baked in me that selfishness of I do what I want to do. I want the flexibility to say, if the Eagles are in the Super Bowl, I'm going to get on that plane and go, because I don't have to worry about, you know, other people. I want the flexibility of if Pearl Jam's playing a concert, you know, and that comes with some sacrifices on the other side of it. So I've gotten to do a lot of cool shit. I mean, you know, you called me famous at the beginning. Like, I went on a television show in 2020, The Bachelorette. It was in the middle of COVID. You know, I don't talk about that experience much because there's just not a lot to say, but I will say, in this environment, the takeaway from that and what has remained true for the 4 years since I did that was, I basically told my story to this entire country, and where I thought I was going to get hate, and there was some of that, which is hilarious, and we can laugh at the crackhead, the junkie, the this, the that. The overwhelming outpouring of support and love and identification was next level. And so, you know, as a result of that, sure, have I, you know, like, last month, was I on the field at the Eagles game? Yes. Have I gotten to do some cool things? Yes. But to your point, like, these conversations are the ones that, whether the microphones are here or not, like, I don't even see the but like, these are the things that I really enjoy and appreciate, because it's this moment in time of just human connection.
When I've watched The Bachelorette show one time, one season, it's when you were on it, because all of us were excited that you were on it. And the thing that, and I talk about it to some people, and I say that the way you were able to be transparent, the way you were able to be seen, instead of trying to make everybody think you're something, to actually be you, is so attractive. So attractive that you got the girl.
Yeah.
There were some, you know, good-looking, smart guys that were there, but I don't think that anybody was like you. And that's why you guys connected.
Well, look, I think the thing there for me is, I lived for a long time, and I don't know that I was aware of it, hating myself in a very in a very kind of underground, bizarre way. Like, I wouldn't tell you at the time that I hated myself, but clearly I hated myself based on the way that I was behaving. And this probably goes into like the last part of this conversation, which is sobriety and recovery in the world today. When I got sober, something shifted inside of me where I, the person whose opinion was going to matter the most on a daily basis was my own. If I can't look in that mirror and actually be happy and know that I'm doing the best I can, then I'm not going to go on any show. I'm not going to be in any relationships. I'm not going to be able to do. And that's what recovery teaches us, right? Like that whole cliche about you better put your oxygen mask on first so you can help other people. It's true. And that's why we see people with 15, 20, 25, 30 years go out, because they start to fade away from the work and they start hating themselves again. And so in that example that you give with the TV show, I mean, look, man, at the end of the day, like, I made a promise myself before stepping on any set, even this morning walking in here, I'm just going to be who I am. And if people don't like it, what a gift. What a gift that I know that I don't have to waste my time with this person. What a blessing. I get it. You don't like I used to have this fantasy that I was going to be loved by everyone and we were all going to get a like kumbaya and like it's not this world, especially not this world we're living in. The jealousy, the hate, the envy.
Al-Anon program is really helpful in that regard.
Yeah.
Because it one of the offshoots of kind of staying in your lane is letting people do what they do and you do what you do, not trying to control everything. Part of the sickness of trying to make it so everybody loves you is trying to do things that are going to create that kind of result. When you stop trying to do those things, all the noise goes away. You kind of just are able to take care of yourself, do what you have to do. If it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, it's also okay. You're being true to yourself, and it's a lot easier way to live. It's not the way we're taught, though.
I mean, that could be the whole thing. That could be the whole episode. That could be the whole thing right there.
I want to go a little bit into what you give to other people. I don't know what the year was. It was probably about half, maybe 7 years ago, 8 years ago. You're the principal owner of a sober living community for men and for women called Release Recovery.
Yeah. Yeah, it started as a sober living. I mean, we have grown tremendously. It's been such a blessing, and you were part of our early journey. And that was our first, I always knew coming out of treatment. I mean, my dad has built a business. I love business. I love people. I love entrepreneurship. I love building community. So I always knew that there would come a time when, I would go out and do my own thing. And this journey with Release has been incredible. Yes, that was our first house, and I'm very grateful to you and Todd and to everyone that made that possible. And now, we're operating a few houses up there plus a clinic. So we're really doing treatment up in Westchester, which has been incredible. And we're able to take a much more compromised patient or client, if you will. And then in the city here in New York, we have several other residential kind of sober living, transitional living programs. And so 60, 65 beds in total, and then a pretty robust, outpatient coaching, recovery coaching, and event, practice. And so this business has really grown to a place where, we have 85 employees. It's like,
while we're on the subject, just tell people if they want to connect with you and Release, how do they do that? Is there a website or
so you can go to releaserecovery.com, which is our website. You can email me directly. It's just zach@releaserecovery.com. We respond to people. We also have a nonprofit, which I'm not going to go too much into, but between the for-profit and the nonprofit, our kind of thing is if you call us and you need help, we will guarantee that you find some level of help.
Whether it's with Release or someplace else.
Whether it's with Release, whether it's with another provider, we have a good landscape understanding of the landscape with Medicare and Medicaid. Like, people, you know, I was lucky, man. My family was able to pay for me to go get really good care, really good care. And, you know, insurance has gotten a little bit better, but we're still living in a world where if you don't have really good commercial insurance or, you know, a couple zeros in your bank account, you're probably getting some pretty shitty care if you're struggling with a substance abuse issue or a mental health issue.
Why do you like the release platform?
Yeah.
Is something that is like the first line of defense, primarily for, I mean, somebody who's 80 years old might not be the proper for a release, but for so many people that need help when they get out of the primary care, the 28-day treatment or a relapse unit, they have to have a step down before they go back to the world, living in an environment like that. Why is that kind of environment so important? And why did you have such a passion for creating that environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think 28-day treatment is going to go away. I don't think it's going to stand the test of time. I think it's something that was kind of made up. When I think of 28 days in a treatment program, I think of what it looks like when someone's in the ICU. And what is the goal when someone is in the ICU? It's to get them just well enough so that they can take their next step, whatever that might be. And I've spent time in an ICU when I had my brain surgery, and I know what that looks like. And so when someone's in a 28-day program, they might look okay. They might be able to verbally communicate. They might physically be able to get around, but they are just starting their recovery process. And so for me, the value behind what we do at release is, you know, minimum of 84 days or 3 months out to however long, you know, it's kind of deemed that you should be with us or the family, you know, works with us to decide. But we combine like really strong clinical care, which I benefited from and I know the importance of. I still see a therapist on a weekly basis and groups. And we have a doctor and who we stole from Karen, Dr. McCormick, who's amazing. And we combine that with, you know, the things that you're not able to do in a 28-day program. We go out to meetings, we go to the gym, they start to think about their vocational desires, whether that's work or, you know, a lot of our folks have kids, you know, and we work with them to plan these kind of therapeutic visits so they can start to see their families again, so that by the time they're actually ready to quote unquote move out, they're actually kind of already moved out. Like they've built the skill set, they've built the community, and they're prepared to launch into a life that they actually believe they can stay sober in.
As is usually the case with anything Zach Clark does, you take it a little too far. You've really carried this 12th step quite, you know, the 12th step was intended for you to talk to me and tell me how you did it, and then you go home and you're finished. You're doing this to the masses.
Yeah.
Good. It's and the number of people that show up at the galas and the events. I think there's something coming up in January.
We have an event with Karen in January. I think the point you just made though, Corey, and I'm sure you and you know, I don't know how you navigated on this podcast, but you know, my anonymity was taken away from me. Period. You know, like I didn't have that choice of whether I was going to be anonymous or not. I mean, granted, it wasn't taken away from me. I did things in my life, I'll take accountability, that resulted in me losing my anonymity. So I am very much, yes, out there telling my story. And, you know, part of my story, as I've been very vocal about, is like the 12 steps, yeah, saved my life. And for many years, that was kind of attached to me. And this is before any television or anything. He's a 12-step guy. And that's not true. The 12 steps worked for me, and they continue to work for me. The thing that I think is important for other people to hear, and this might not be the hot take, is that there are other ways that I've seen people recover. And there are other groups and methodologies and ways. I've seen people get sober in gyms, you know, but the key thing throughout all of the ways that I've seen people recover is that you got to find community. You got to do things that get you outside of yourself. You got to be connecting with other people. There's got to be a service component. You know, and those things are all things that I found in my recovery. And so what I do, what I see I myself doing is, yeah, you could equate it to a 12th step, but it's also just like, look, man, if I say one thing on this podcast and one person hears it and they say, oh, I'm going to give this a shot, then we're good. We did our job for the day. I would just add that it's just a personal choice, man. If someone wants to recover in silence, that is their own prerogative. Like truly. You know, I always, one of the main questions I get living in New York when someone's going to get sober is, well, how do I go out to a bar? How do I go on dates? And I explain to them, I say, if you're on a date and you order a club soda and the person across from you asks you, why aren't you drinking? And you give an easy response of, oh, I don't drink. One, you're not saying that you're an alcoholic. You're not declaring that you're like sober. You're just saying, I don't drink, in a very casual, matter-of-fact way. If the person across the table then takes that information, knowing nothing else about you, and chooses to judge you or make fun of you, again, what is that? It's a blessing. Cool, this isn't going to work then, because I don't want to be with someone that's so close-minded that when I tell them I don't drink, they immediately judge me. And it's just, it's funny because most of the story that we tell ourselves is self-made. It's manufactured. It's not true. I have owned the fact that I don't drink in social settings for many, many years. I mean, I can tell you maybe on one or two fingers how many times someone has really said to me, like, you know, call me names because I don't drink. That's in 13 years. So it's just, we're talking about things, we're spending time on things that just don't actually matter. It's about what you were talking about earlier. It's like just owning who you are in a way that feels good to you. And so if I had to go through what I had to go through as a kid and in high school and college and after college to get to where I am today, like, it was all worth it. I think the thing that, I'm a pretty sensitive guy. I have big feelings. And so where I try to get and where I would try to get with a younger Zach is just kind of the idea that it's never as good as it seems and it's never as bad as it seems. And it's all going to be okay. Like, it's all going to be okay. And then I would also, you know, there's a spiritual element of this life that I get to live, you know, where I'm not afraid to fail. I'm not afraid to die. You know, I'm not afraid to see what happens when this existence ends. And I think as a child, I was, you know, there were many nights where I would go to sleep. Like, one of my earliest memories is, like, my parents would come in and read to me or whatever, and I would actually calculate in my head. I was like, okay, if I die at 30, then I won't have to watch my parents die. You know, like, that's the crazy thoughts that I would have as a kid. And, like, the spiritual life that we get to live and we choose to live allows us to be free and be here in this moment. And you're going to go have a good day, and I'm going to go have a good day. And, you know, that's a long way of saying of, like, I wouldn't change anything, but I would just tell younger Zach that it's all good.
It's going to be okay.
And you're not God. So stop trying to control everything.
That's a good piece.
Yeah.
Zach, thank you so much for being on Crosstalk. Everybody should watch the Zach Clark podcast. The Zach Clark Show. Shit. It's the Zach Clark Show. And if you need help, go to releaserecovery.com. Zach's right there. And he helps so many people.
Thank you.
So anyway, thank you, everybody. By the way, I should say before, just like, subscribe, hit the bell, give us some comments, blah, 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 blah. But thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time.